I always use this phrase that when you go out to dine in a normal restaurant, you end up sort of marrying a veal chop for the night. And when all you want to do is eat off of everybody else's plates. And Suzanne and I would go out to dine ourselves. We'd end up sitting at a bar somewhere because we liked that better. It was more casual. And we would end up sharing small plates. We'd order 5 different appetizers, a couple of entrees, and we really loved that whole idea that you didn't have to commit to one thing and you could kind of taste your way through.
When we first opened, it was 10 years ago, and we were worried people wouldn't get it. We opened this restaurant. It was before there weren't any other small plate restaurants, so people would come in and see these lists of dishes. The first thing we had to convince them that it wasn't tapas, and that the idea was it's a family style, really. So you order lots of things, and you pass them around and share. And we were sure that people were going to want their farro and their cavallonero and their steak on the same plate. And we had all these plans of how we were going to talk people into it and this and that. And actually, people came and we told them what we were doing. And they're like, oh, okay, let's try that. And I just think that's such a great testament to the LA dining community that people were really open to that idea.
Believe it or not, 10 years ago, small plates weren't a thing. Neither was cavallonero, a.k.a. dinosaur kale, or farro. When the restaurant AOC opened 10 years ago, Suzanne Goen and Carolyn Stein pioneered the concept of vegetable-driven, family-style dining that we've come to expect from LA restaurants. And today on the show, we get to thumb through their cookbook. Get ready for duck sausage and candied kumquats, and a glass of Pinot. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I hope you're hungry. It's Good Food from KCRW.
So, here we go.
No one understands egg yolks the way you do.
I want to speak to the person in charge of the cooking program.
I'm Evan Kleiman.
Leave the gun. Take the canal.
Suzanne Goen and Carolyn Stein are LA's culinary dream team. Together, they own Loop, AOC, Tavern, and The Larders. The new AOC cookbook, which they co-authored, showcases what they do best. Carolyn's food-friendly wine program, and Suzanne, what I would call your deceptively simple style of cooking. Looking at the recipes, they are so smart, they're layered, but the food is so familiar.
It's sort of, like you said, deceptively simple. And I think a lot of times when people are eating, there's certain notes and things that I've done just with technique or with adding certain little ingredients, or whether it's an herb or an acid or something, that is bringing out the flavor of those ingredients. I actually talk about in the book about the whole farm to table, you know, in quotes thing, which to me is so funny because that's how I've been cooking basically as long as I've been cooking for like 25 years. That's how.
You're so lucky.
That's how I've been cooking because I was lucky. I worked at Al Forno in Providence. I worked at Chez Panisse. I worked at places where that's how you decided what to make was what was growing and available. And so the idea that farm to table is your style to me is really strange. Like farm to table that's the starting point. You get your vegetable, you get all your produce and your vegetables and your meats and your ingredients, you get everything locally and in season and sustainably raised. And then it's what you do with that. And actually, I think if you look around town and you look at all the different chefs that shop at the market, we all take those ingredients and do very different things with them.
So Carolyn, is there a sort of parallel argument about wine, the sort of equivalent of farm to table versus more refined?
Oh, absolutely. I definitely look at winemakers the same way I look at chefs. And just like we connect with farmers as people and build relationships with them, I end up doing the same thing with winemakers. And there are people who are really dedicated to taking care of the earth and taking care of the fruit on the vine and letting what they've reaped from nature speak in the bottle versus manipulating it, turning it into some sort of mass-produced thing and trying to sort of manipulate it to be what they think other people want.
And so then we get to the name of the restaurant, AOC, which is, I think, even more interesting now than it was then with the globalization of everything we eat and we drink. How hard was it to come up with the name, and how in the heck did you come up with that one?
We'll both laugh when you ask this question.
Yeah, we laugh because we're notorious among ourselves, terrible restaurant namers. It's so hard. I mean, when we were coming up with the restaurant with Luke, we had all the ideas. We had everything. We'd pick the plates out. We'd pick the paint. We had everything figured out, but we didn't have a name. And somebody said to us, like, oh, well, you need graphics. Okay, great. Carolyn knew somebody who was a graphic designer, so we were telling him all, you know, what the place is going to be and all that. And he's like, okay, that's great. So what's the name? We're like, oh, well, we don't have a name yet. And he just looked at us. He's like, okay, no name, no graphics. Like, go away and come back when you have a name. And it was funny because we went back and forth, had all these different contenders, and we were talking about it and probably drinking coffee. And I had this notebook that I used to work in because it was before everybody worked on the computer all the time. And I opened up this page of my Il Bassante notebook, and I had written Luke like 5,000 times, like in cursive, in blocky letters, and colored it in. And Carolyn looked at me and she goes, I think maybe you want to name the restaurant Luke.
That's so funny. Like when you're in junior high school and you start.
Oh, it was like the boy I had a crush on in junior high school. Exactly. But when we were trying to come up with the name for AOC, you know, we were going to really have this big focus on cheese and wine, and we went through different varietals. You know, maybe we'd name it after a varietal, or we'd name it after a cheese. And then that started to feel too specific. So we were, again, down to our insurance guy had called us and said, okay, you guys need to have the name by Monday at 9, or your rates are going to double. So we're like, I remember Sunday night, like sitting in my house, going through pages of cheese books and wine books and all these things. And I started realizing all these cheeses that I really loved were AOC cheeses. And I called Carolyn, and she was like, she had actually been thinking of the same thing. So we decided that was the name.
So you chose a name that's very easy to say in our letters, but now you have to explain what it is 4,000 times.
Right.
Daily,
yeah.
And one more time here for us, please.
Appellation d'origine contrôlée. It's the appellation system in France that governs the production of wines, cheeses, all sorts of other artisanal products, olive oils, and similar to DOC in Italy, DOP, AVA in California. It's really about that sense of place and that sense of tradition.
So let's talk about a dish, a specific dish that would be great for now. And you can tell us about the process of making it, and Carolyn can chime in with wine notes. I'm thinking your duck sausage with candied kumquats.
The duck sausage with candied kumquats, that's one of my favorites. And it's a really, really simple dish to make, and I think it's, I would love for people to make more sausage at home, and especially, I think sometimes the casing part freaks people out, so just to not even worry about that part, and just crumble the sausage into a pan and sauté it, and or make little patties. The duck itself is very simple. It's just, it's duck leg, and pancetta, and salt, and thyme, and a little back fat, and that's it. I love playing with the sweet and salty. I also always want some kind of greens, so I love kumquats. Kumquats to me are one of those things, when kumquats go out of season, I kind of freak out, and I keep nagging at Peter Shaner. I'm like, I'm sure there's one more tree. Don't you have something? He's like, I have a tree, but they're all green. Like, you need to stop and move on to another fruit. But there is something about a kumquat that has, I think it's that the combination of the chewiness of the skin and that really bright, intense acidity and sort of citrus burst. So I just thought to just poach those really, really lightly in a syrup, and you'd get so the sweetness from the syrup and then that bright burst, and then just serve it with a little frisée salad.
And for you, Carolyn, the one flavor profile you didn't mention really much is your sour. And mm-hmm. a lot of you love vinaigrettes.
Mm-hmm. I do.
You love playing with sour. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one thing that really informs your food and gives it so much more depth, is that there's always a little hint of bitter, always a little bit of sour,
right,
and then the sweet and the salty. So how do you find a wine to go with that?
Suzanne's food is incredibly wine-friendly. And it is exactly what you're talking about. There's always the highs and the lows, the depth and the brightness all in one. And it's a very similar experience with wine. On your palate, it goes through a high and low. The front palate, you get your first taste, and then there's usually this arc of flavor. And I really tried to pair wines with Suzanne's food that mimic that arc of flavor. It's funny, in the book I give wine notes with each recipe. And for me, that kumquat is what is screaming out to me. And so I always think of Pinot Noir. Of course, duck for me always calls out Pinot. I want something that's red, a little warm, blankety. Pinot Noir has that beautiful bright red cherry note in it. And they tend to have this sort of rich citrus element, especially if you're dealing with something maybe from Santa Maria Valley, maybe Sonoma, that has a little bit of fruitiness in the wine, and then have really great acidity that will follow that sort of arc on the palate that the whole recipe has.
Thank you so much. I mean, this is the kind of book that will be on people's shelves forever and will ultimately become totally food and wine spattered. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Chef Suzanne Goen and wine director Carolyn Stein are partners in Luke, AOC, Tavern, and the Larders here in L.A. Their new AOC cookbook should be on everyone's holiday shopping list. But meanwhile, you can find a recipe for Suzanne's duck sausage with candied kumquats, plus Carolyn's wine pairing on her blog. And if you want to see the ladies and get a signed book, they will be at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this coming Wednesday, November 13th. Coming up, Chinese author Mo Yan won the 2012 Nobel Prize for Literature. And he writes about food in the most bizarre and fascinating way. KCRW bookworm Michael Silverblatt joins me to dissect his recent novel.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Welcome back to Good Food. The Chinese author and 2012 Nobel Prize winner for literature, Mo Yan, is no stranger to writing about food. Red Sorghum, The Garlic Ballads, and The Republic of Wine are just three of the novels by this prolific author. His more recent novel, Pow, chronicles the story of a carnivorous boy obsessed with meat. In some ways, it's reminiscent of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle in its commentary on meat consumption, industry, and corruption. And today, to help us dissect this fascinating novel, I've invited KCRW's bookworm host, Michael Silverblatt, to join me in the studio.
I thought it was just great to be invited onto Good Food to discuss Pow, this book which is about bad food. I mean, face it, this is about adulterated food, corrupted food, poisoned food, as a metaphor for all of culture. In other words, it says people are hungry, and when they are hungry, they will eat anything, and they'll drool, they'll salivate over it. And this is his way of talking about the Cultural Revolution and about human culture, the culture of hunger, the culture of starvation, and the class system that gives the poor. Well, in this book, the meat is injected with formaldehyde.
Yeah, it gives people like death masquerading as life.
And not only death masquerading as life, the people become, or at least this narrator, positively vivacious when they think about meat. And when they think about meat, it's not just meat that doesn't smell bad because the formaldehyde makes it look very pleasant. It's every kind of entrail and dog meat. Eventually, he gets to taste some seafood. I think dead center in the book, fish enters the picture as a special gift from a patron. But for the most part, he wants to eat more than he can hold. Part of the reward of meat is overconsumption. And, well, it's not a book, let me say it, to read on an upset stomach.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because the main character in so much of the book is a child, and he's torn between these two poles. His father, who is this sort of savant butcher, known for being able to estimate weight of the cow on the hoof down to the last milligram, and a mother whose frugality is almost psychopathic.
The father has run off with another woman. As such, he represents impurity in the novel. The mother's frugality, oddly, stands for purity because she gives the child vegetables to eat. And he feels he's being punished, but he may just be eating the only healthy food around that there is. And so he yearns for the return of his father.
Yeah, one of the things that fascinated me was, within the metaphor, just the image that Mo Yan portrays of this child yearning for grease, yearning for satiation.
Both he and his little sister, illegitimate little sister, she said to abhor the use of chopsticks. She likes to use her hands and rub the grease on her face until she's glistening. And he loves to watch her. He takes a sardine out of a can and feeds her, makes her sit up straight and feeds her. He says she eats like she's a kitten going after the tiny fish. It really is a society. We watch it. We see the consequences of it that has dealt with hunger for such a long time that eating anything at all has become a matter of survival. Eating a lot of it has become a matter of pleasure.
Did you find any point in the book that he veered into a more traditional type of food writing in which he just describes something simple and pleasurable?
I'm trying to think. At one point, he does go and visit the very rich leader of the village, and they are eating well. Now, typically, this leader is the person who has discovered that not only can you make meat weigh more by injecting water into it, but you can make it look better by injecting formaldehyde. The stupid dealers in the slaughterhouse village just use water. He's an intelligent vendor. He uses water and formaldehyde, but at home, they eat very well. And when he's not talking about food, he gives great food metaphors. The first time the narrator, who's a little boy, he gets drunk, and he says, "I didn't feel like I was floating like a feather on the wind. I felt like a melon floating in a river." And you think, that is a great Chinese metaphor for drunkenness. How perfect. And it's as if, yes, growing up as he did in the Chinese countryside, Mo Yan thinks about food all the time. You start to think, not just as a writer, as a culture, this is a country where food means something different from what it's meant to us growing up in America.
Michael, that was incredible. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've taken your advice so many times, and I've eaten your pies, and I'm just so shocked that my beloved Evan Kleinman had me reading a book that made me feel so nauseous so frequently. Were you punishing me?
No, I thought to myself, Michael is a big enough literature geek that he's one of the only people I could get to read this book and share his thoughts with me.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. Michael Silverblatt is the host of Bookworm on KCRW. We've been talking about Pao, a book by Chinese author Mo Yan. Coconut water was in the news this week. A headline from the online news outlet Quartz read, quote, "Health nuts are guzzling coconut water faster than aging palms can produce it," unquote. This pattern, how familiar is it? We find a product, fall in love, and before we know it, we've depleted our supply, wreaking havoc on Mother Earth in the process. Sometimes we forget what sustainability is all about. Take tequila, for instance. When was the last time you asked your bartender, how was that blue agave in that tequila farmed? Never, right? The natural growth and harvest cycle of the blue agave plant in Jalisco is in trouble, and David Ciro Piñera is trying to save it. He's a native of Jalisco, now living in Philadelphia, where he founded the Tequila Interchange Project. It's an organization that advocates sustainable, traditional, and quality practices in the tequila industry. Hi, David.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. But I understand that we're in the midst of an agave shortage. Can you explain how that happens and what it means for growers and consumers?
Yes. Well, this is an issue that we experienced in the tequila industry for many, many years. We have to take in consideration that the Agave Tequilana Weber, which is the only species that we use, that we allowed by the regulations of tequila to use in its production, it takes up to 12 years to reach maturity. So it's very difficult for producers to anticipate what type of demand is going to be 8, 10, 12 years ahead. So we've been witness multiple situations that are similar to the one that we are going into right now. The first one that we have records is on 1919. It happens during an epidemic in Mexico of Spanish influenza, when some doctors decide to prescribe this tequila to help to minimize the effects of the influenza. The one that we experience right now is a combination of different reasons. One of them is the agaves are getting weaker and weaker.
Why is that?
Well, you know, the plants are, they're incredible plants. They can reproduce in different ways. And the way that we've been, you know, generalizing is we've been doing only by through the offshoots, through what we call hijuelos, which are little plants to grow from the mother plant, but genetically they are identical.
So it's like when we have a succulent in our garden here in Southern California, and we see like a little rosette of the same plant starts to form at the base of a stem, and we can just pluck that off and root it and then put it in the ground.
Exactly. You have genetically, it's pretty much it's a clone of the mother plant. But what we're doing by using this type of reproduction, we are getting the plants weaker and weaker. So the plants, you know, they are more susceptible for disease, for attack of insects. And so we have a lot of health issues on the agave and the agave fields. And also, you know, recently in the last 3 months, China finally opened up the doors for the importations of 100% agave tequila. You can imagine the demand that this market is going to require from tequila producers. So you have like, you know, a perfect storm forming. We start to see prices increasing drastically in the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm. I'm so intrigued by both aspects that you've talked about. First, let me ask you about the way the plant reproduces. Do growers ever let plants get old so that the flower spike comes up so it can be, you can have seed?
Well, you know, in other agave distilled spirits, producers, farmers, they do that. They use those practices. But in the tequila industry, I can say that 100% of the reproduction of agaves is only through cloning. And unfortunately, we don't see any producers on the tequila industry. They are pushing for going back to the pollinization and, you know, the sexual reproduction. You have to remember also that when you allow the quiotes, which is the stem that it grows from the heart of the agave, where the plant is going to develop the flowers and seeds, we not allow that quiote, which is the sexual organ of the plant, we not allow to grow. If we allow the quiotes to grow, that will dry out the heart of the agave, where all the sugars are concentrated for production of tequila.
Do you think the day will come when some people become like seedsmen, for example, for cauliflower? There are cauliflower farmers who grow cauliflower, and then there are just farmers who just grow the seeds. Can you see a time where there'll be fields set apart just for creating this other kind of growth?
Well, you know, that's something that we really want to push for. I mean, recently I just came back from Mexico where we were doing a documentary on bats as pollinizers of the agave. Different species of bats, they fly from all over from United States and from all over Mexico. And one of their main foods are is the agave nectar, the flowers of the agave. But because we don't do it, this migration of bats, they are changing to different areas. They are avoiding the tequila corridor. And, you know, we try to push for farmers to allow to grow at least a small percentage of their agaves to grow quiotes. And therefore, we can protect not just the agaves, but the entire ecosystem where we grow agaves. But unfortunately, we don't see that many incentives of interest from producers. But it's something, it's a project that we're working on it and try to create some sort of certification on the label for tequila producers, you know, promoting the reproduction, the sexual reproduction of the agaves. But as we're speaking, unfortunately, nobody's doing it.
And that sexual reproduction, it will reinvigorate the plant stock, wouldn't it?
Of course. Of course. You know, on the mezcal industry, to the contrary, something that they've been very wise and protect is all the different varieties of agaves they are using for production of mezcal. They are allowed to use up to 27 different varieties of agaves, which take the stress away from only one species, like the in the case of tequila.
Wow, that is so interesting, because it's blue agave on the label now is such a symbol of quality and also of class, almost, in terms of how you order in a bar or in a restaurant. And to know that by making that choice, you're making a very unsustainable choice in a way is really sad. Thank you so much. What a fascinating subject.
Thank you. Thank you. This is great.
We have links to the Tequila Interchange Project, headed up by David Zeropiniera, on our website. According to David, some botanists are saying that the generations of agave plants that are in the fields right now are sterile. Can you imagine that? So even as awareness of this issue grows, the forecast for the actual plant, the pure blue agave that creates this incredible tequila, is uncertain. My hope is that a forward-thinking farmer will manage to get his or her hands on some seed and plant an agave seed farm. A girl can dream, right? In a minute, Jonathan Gold is here to talk about pizza, pasta, and the exploding downtown restaurant scene.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Jonathan Gold's with me now to catch us up on where we should eat this weekend in L.A. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the L.A. Times and a weekly fixture right here on Good Food. Today, we're going to what is undoubtedly the hotbed for new restaurants, downtown L.A.
Everything's opening downtown now. I can't tell you how many years I used to get complaints from people saying, "You only cover the West Side," even though I also got complaints saying I was only covering the San Gabriel Valley, but that's another question. And now I still get those complaints, but mostly it's like, why is every single restaurant downtown?
I know. It's really amazing. I mean, I just have noticed over the past 3 months that half of every week I spend driving east.
We're going to Tironi, which is the mammoth new branch of the Midtown Pizza Pasta restaurant.
So it's really big. I mean, I haven't gone yet. How big is it?
6,500, 7,000 square feet.
Wow.
The ceilings are enormous. It used to be, as so many things were in that neighborhood, a bank. And so you have those giant bank ceilings. You have like glassed in wine vaults. You have one part with an open kitchen and one part the kitchen seems a million miles away. You have volumes between the music and the people talking that have like 93, 94 decibels sometimes, or it's as loud as if you were standing next to a motorcycle. I love bringing my decibel meter to restaurants.
You actually have a decibel meter that you bring?
I used to bring a physical one. Now I just have an iPhone app, but it's fascinating.
What's the loudest restaurant you've been to?
Bestia.
Bestia?
Yeah.
Is louder than Bottega Louie?
Yeah. Bestia, I mean, day in, day out, Bestia is just deafening. Bottega Louie is really loud, but I think the height of the ceilings makes it sound maybe a little more diffuse.
So interesting. This is like a whole other subject we could talk about.
And we're not talking about lounge restaurants where the music can get much, much louder than that, but restaurants that you would go to eat as opposed to restaurants where you would go to drink fancy cocktails and nibble edamame beans.
So we're at Tironi.
We're at Tironi.
What street is it on?
It's on Spring Street. It's in the same neighborhood that Alma is in, Umami Katessen. It's there. The dearly departed parish, which I liked a lot, was just down the block. And, of course, the new Ace Hotel is going to open within a block of there, too. We're not done with restaurants in this neighborhood.
Not by a long shot. So share your experience with the food at Tironi.
Tironi is a restaurant that, when it originally opened in Toronto, was famous for denying people things. I mean, the sort of like the pizza Nazi equivalent of the sushi Nazi or the soup Nazi or the
hamburger Nazi.
Yeah, and they still have a lot of the rules there. Like the pizza is really nice. It's sort of vaguely Neapolitan. It's done in a wood oven, I believe. It's not super thin, but thin enough, and they managed to do it so it's completely crisp throughout. You don't have the sogged out spots that you usually get with Neapolitan pizza. But they have this rule, for example, that they will not cut the pizza before they bring it to the table. They hand you a steak knife and tell you to do it yourself.
So they want it to be more Italian.
They want it to be more Italian. I don't think I ever saw a pizza cutter in Italy.
No, never.
Their accommodations for pizza are odd, and they will not alter them in any way.
So give me an example.
Like something called the puzza, which is like a—
Which means the stink.
I know. They're all named—
I love that.
Stuff like that. A white pizza with mozzarella and mascarpone, gorgonzola, mushrooms, and a prosciutto of some kind. And if you want it without the prosciutto, you're out of luck. If you think the gorgonzola is too much on your pizza, you're also out of luck. My favorite pizza there is called, and I believe I'm pronouncing this wrong, the tutti-mange, which apparently is a thing in southern Italy. It's a popular combination, but it's, again, it's a pizza without tomatoes, with mozzarella, gorgonzola, sliced fresh pears, walnuts, and sort of a layering of speck, which I believe goes on after the pizza is cooked.
What is speck?
It's a smoked sort of prosciutto from the way north of Italy, which makes it like a really kind of delicious mixed antipasto plate as opposed to a pizza. It's good on a pizza.
Yeah, delicious. So what about the pastas?
As is the fashion now, all the pastas are made fresh every day. And while, you know, some of the pastas you might wish were made from dried, I mean, I don't think anybody likes fresh spaghetti better than they like made from dried spaghetti. It just doesn't ever quite get the right texture. They're good. The sauces tend towards southern Italy, or they're better when they tend towards southern Italy. So there's something they call the macaroncini geppetto, with sautéed bitter greens, dandelions and radicchio mostly, spicy sausage, a little bit of fontino, and some oil.
That sounds delicious.
It does. They do a really good spaghetti al limone, you know, simple with a little bit of spinach, a little bit of onion, and, you know, a spritz of lemon and good olive oil. It's basic, but it's really good. The place where it starts to get maybe overdone is when they try to do northern things that might have too much cream in them, or their bucatini alla matriciana, which is really stodgy. Stick to the pasta norma with the fried eggplant. You'll be happy.
That was Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about the new outpost of Tironi in downtown LA. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's favorite dishes by texting the words good food to the number 69866. Just text good food to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on our restaurant map. It lives on our blog. Sometimes weather isn't the best indicator of seasonal changes in LA, but the farmers market is always a good indicator. It was 75 degrees on Wednesday at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, yet autumn was everywhere on the tables. Let's check in with market manager Laura Avery to see what fall produce is popping up this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting today with Robert Wemishner, who is the instructor of professional baking at the LA Trade Tech College. Robert's a regular visitor here at the market with his class, excitedly in tow. Robert, what are you looking for at this time of year, and what are you going to be cooking?
You know, I love to see the arrival of late fall fruits, and what is most catching my eye are the persimmons. I mean, they're beautiful to look at, they're sculptural, and they're delicious, and they come in a number of varieties, of course. So the ones I'm going to look for today are the fuyu, which we can eat when they're hard. They don't need to be soft like the hachia varieties, so they are sweet when they're hard. They're like eating an apple, in a sense, but beautiful, crunchy. I like to peel them, of course, but I want to pair them this time with another fruit that appears, and that is pomegranates. So pomegranates, you know, are this ruby red juice that is tart, in a sense, somewhat sweet, but really tart in my mind. So I like to pair the sweetness of the persimmon with the tartness of the pomegranate in the juice form, and we poach the persimmons in pomegranate juice. And then the liquid that results is reduced down to a glaze and poured over this beautiful sliced persimmon. And one more ingredient that's added, which is also very seasonal, are these beautiful thin-skinned walnuts. I roast them in the oven so they become aromatic, and we scatter them over the fruit that has been poached, maybe a little bit of whipped cream or Greek yogurt on top, and we've got a beautiful seasonal dessert simply.
And you said you peel them.
I peel them, yeah. The skin really doesn't break down. It sort of remains kind of tough, so I'd prefer to peel them. Use an apple peeler, you know, just the same, or a small knife if you're deft at doing that.
Now, how are you getting the pomegranate juice out of the pomegranate?
That's a good question. I mean, very carefully and with lots of, you know, washable clothing, aprons and stuff over us. But the best way to do it really is to cut open the fruit, put it in a bowl of water. The seeds will go to the top, and the white membrane pith goes to the bottom, and you take those seeds, and then I would put them even in a food processor and just run them, you know, kind of quickly, and then put the whole thing through a sieve.
And then do you add anything other than pomegranate juice to the poaching liquid?
You know, I try to get away from using extra sugar, and I'd like to just keep it natural, so I keep it just as it is. The persimmons have enough natural sugar, and the pomegranates do themselves, that you just have a nice balance, and you're not adding anything processed.
All right, well, what a great, simple, seasonal recipe. Thanks for the inspiration.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure always.
That was Robert Wemishner with yet another totally inspiring seasonal recipe that he gets here at the farmers market. Robert is the instructor of professional baking at the Trade Tech College in Los Angeles, and he's here with a large group of students, and they are going to be just cooking it up all day today. Scott Peacock is a farmer from Dinuba who's been at the market for many, many years. And Scott grows several varieties of persimmons, which are in season right now. He also grows those walnuts that Robert was talking about. But Scott, talk to us about the persimmons and the difference between the... Just tell us about persimmons.
Okay, and you said something about taking the bloom off. I know this isn't TV, but you see that?
Yeah.
That's the natural bloom.
So the bloom, it's sort of like a white, almost like people might think it's mold.
Well, you know what it is? It's kind of almost like a little wax coating. And so what I do, I have to be very, very careful that I bring them, pick them, and pack them so that I don't disturb that. Otherwise, if it gets marked a little bit, it doesn't look as nice.
Right.
You'll see some persimmons in the market are shiny, 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 shiny. That's because they've done something to get the bloom off, but I like to bring them naturally with the bloom on. The one that I'm talking to you about here is called a fuyu persimmon. It's a little flat persimmon that is crunchy, crunchy, crunchy. Eat it crunchy like an apple. And what people like to use that for is a garnish. And if you slice that across the persimmon, there's a little star shape in there that looks like a sand dollar. So that's pretty. The bigger ones that I have out on the front of the table, I call it a giant fuyu. It's the same way. You eat it crunchy, and it starts earlier in the season. So I've been selling those now for over 3 weeks. This one here is our first day in with this fuyu.
The giant fuyu, it's more elongated. The other one we were talking about is flatter.
Yeah, it's
so
round
that's
and
two.
Flat, and the other one is elongated. The Japanese name for that is gosho, but I call it a giant fuyu because it's the crunchy apple persimmon as well. Another one that I haven't brought yet has got a pointy end on it, It's a bigger persimmon, and this one is called hachia. And the hachia, you have to eat that mushy, like soft, otherwise it's astringent. And people know that traditionally to bake with. That one is a little late this year for some reason. I usually have soft persimmons this time of year, and they haven't softened up. It's been too warm. We need cold nights and cold days to make them soften up.
So, Scott, we all know when the hachia is ripe, when it's so soft it practically melts in your hand. But on the fuyus, how do you know when they're really prime ripe?
What I do is I do it more by color. They go from green to yellow to orange to dark orange, and then they'll finally soften. And I catch them right at that stage as they're going from yellow to orange. And so that's optimum. Best flavor and crunch, good shelf life that way.
Now, will they continue to get more orange after they're picked?
Yeah, they'll change color a little bit, and they'll eventually go soft. They continue to ripen after they're harvested.
But as they get softer, they're still just as good to eat.
They're good to eat, but most people like the crunch because they put them in salads, or they're using them as a garnish, or you're eating them like an apple.
Yeah. Well, thanks. It's all beautiful, and that one little persimmon I munched on just now is delicious.
Wonderful. Nice to visit with you this morning.
That was Scott Peacock. He's a farmer from Dinuba. He is truly a small family farm. He and his wife, Linda, do a lot of the work there. And his table is full of persimmons, pomegranates, fresh walnuts, and dried fruit. Just great to visit. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Robert Wemishner's persimmons poached in pomegranate juice with toasted walnuts is on the Good Food blog. If you try it and have extra ingredients left over, toss the persimmons, pomegranate seeds, and walnuts in a salad. Oh, so good with Belgian endive. We've also got an outtake about hoshigachi, the Japanese technique for drawing persimmons, on our blog. It's extraordinary. If you've never seen it, really, check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. There was some major news out of the FDA this week. Trans fats, or partially hydrogenated oils, are under scrutiny again. This time, it's not just New York and California. On Thursday, the FDA proposed a measure that could mostly eliminate them from our food supply. Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson has the story.
There were some confusing headlines on Thursday surrounding the FDA's recent actions on trans fat. Some headlines suggested that the FDA was banning partially hydrogenated oil, which is not the case yet.
It's not a ban because it's not a final action.
Dr. Michael Jacobson is the co-founder and executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. I called him to get the nitty-gritty on what the FDA's proposal really means.
The FDA has tentatively concluded that the ingredient partially hydrogenated vegetable oil shouldn't be allowed in foods because it contains trans fat. And trans fat is the most harmful kind of fat in the food supply.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, that 25% of trans fat that's still left in food is responsible for roughly 5,000 deaths a year.
Getting rid of trans fat is one of the most important life-saving measures that the FDA could take.
So you may remember that California, New York City, Philadelphia, Seattle, and a few other cities banned trans fats. But that was only for restaurants and bakeries, not packaged foods. Those are up to the FDA.
So the FDA is saying now the rest of the food industry should do what all the responsible companies have done and replace partially hydrogenated oil with healthier oils. And we'll see if the FDA finalizes this action. But it has set aside 60 days for comments from the public, from industry and others. And then it will have to make a final decision, probably sometime next year.
Trying to prove that trans fat is not harmful is pretty much a lost cause for the industry at this point. So I asked Dr. Jacobson what these snack food companies might gain from the 60-day comment period.
They could say, give us more time to get rid of them, or my product, I make cherry turnovers, and there's no other way to make cherry turnovers than by using partially hydrogenated oil. So some companies might ask for exemptions. But I haven't heard anybody defend the safety of trans fat.
This proposal is a huge boon for public health advocates. And according to Dr. Jacobson, one that has been a very long time coming.
The FDA is slow. The Center for Science in the Public Interest first petitioned FDA for labeling in 1994, and then we petitioned the FDA to ban partially hydrogenated oil in 2004. So it'll be a decade at least before the FDA finally bans partially hydrogenated oil. One thing that's important to recognize is that many categories of food still contain trans fat, microwave popcorn, pie crusts, and so on. In each of those categories, you can find brands that don't contain trans fat. And that indicates quite clearly that companies that still use partially hydrogenated oil should be able to get rid of it.
So what will they replace it with? And will it be worse for us?
Fortunately, when companies reformulate their products, every substitution is either healthier or less harmful than trans fat. Butter, palm oil, coconut oil, nothing is as bad as trans fat. So that's not a concern.
This move from the FDA makes you wonder if there'll be a domino effect. After trans fats go, what's next? Soda? High fructose corn syrup? For Dr. Jacobson, the next battle is salt.
When trans fat was in its heyday a decade ago, there were estimates that it was causing 50,000 or more premature deaths every year. Salt is worse. Salt is the single most harmful thing in the food supply, probably causing about 100,000 premature deaths every year. And that's the next biggie for the FDA to tackle. And it's obviously, FDA is not going to ban salt or other sodium-containing ingredients, but it can take measures to reduce sodium levels to safer levels in various categories of food.
Dr. Michael Jacobson is the co-founder and executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He's been campaigning for a ban on trans fats for decades. But Americans are divided. According to Pew Research Center, 52% of Americans oppose the potential ban on trans fats. For Good Food, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Coming up, more in food politics news. Last week, $5 billion in food stamps were cut from the congressional budget. Find out how this sleeper legislation came to pass next.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Back in 2009, as part of the economic stimulus program, Congress increased food stamp benefits to ease the hardship that was being felt by the recession. But since the Great Recession began almost 6 years ago, the number of people on food stamps has, are you ready for this, doubled. Today, nearly 48 million Americans are on food stamps. That's up from 26 million in 2007. To put those numbers in perspective, that means that 15% of the population, almost 1 in 6 Americans, participate in SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, more commonly referred to as food stamps. I read recently that these numbers mean that poverty is the new mainstream. But last week, this money was drastically cut by automatic reductions of $5 billion for a family of four. That translates to a loss of $36 a month in benefits.
You know, it may not sound like much to you or me, but it's several days worth of meals.
Lisa Davis is the Senior Vice President for Government Relations at Feeding America, an organization that runs a number of food banks across the country. On KCRW's To the Point, she described what $36 means at the grocery store.
You could buy a gallon of low-fat milk, a box of cornflakes, 8 bananas, a loaf of wheat bread, some deli ham, some deli cheese, 2 boxes of spaghetti, spaghetti sauce, 1 pound of ground beef, some chicken breasts, and 4 potatoes. So that's a significant amount of food for a low-income family, or for any family.
In her estimation, the recent cuts will translate to 1.9 billion lost meals in 2014. 1.9 billion lost meals. So why did these cuts happen? For a recap, we turn to Arthur Delaney of the Huffington Post. Here's a portion of his conversation with KCRW's Warren Olney earlier this week.
The original plan had never been to let the stimulus bill's benefits increase go away. Originally, what they had thought is we'll increase benefits 13%, And the benefits will stay at that level until many years from now, inflation of food prices catches up to it because food stamp benefit levels are adjusted upward every year. But then in 2010, congressional Democrats needed this money for a couple of other spending bills, one that prevented states from laying off teachers and another that was a priority of First Lady Michelle Obama's, the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which, among other things, gives school lunch to kids. So they took that money, and that moved, that created a deadline, a cliff, essentially, where in 2013, in November, the boost would go away and there would be a reduction. And it amounts to $5 billion now that it's here. And that is a significant amount of money. It's only $10 out of an individual's benefit and $36 for a family of four. But we know that people on food stamps use up all that money way before the end of the month. So it definitely will affect most everyone's budget.
What about the retailers that get the food stamps?
Well, of course. I mean, that's when you look at it at a macro level, that's $5 billion less in benefits sloshing through the economy next year. It's a pretty big reduction, so big, in fact, that it is actually bigger than what Republicans have been trying to do by reforming the program. So it's more than anyone anticipated, and it's essentially a surprise because there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion about it by politicians or by national news organizations.
Is it a surprise that came about because of the change in the Congress from Democratic to Republican control?
Well, it's got a sort of obscure legislative origin, which is these spending bills. And at the time, Democrats knew that this created a food stamp cliff, but they said, well, we'll find a way to put that money back before this can ever happen. And then everyone basically forgot about it. And while they have offered some token legislation to undo the cut, they didn't really make any serious effort. And because they don't want to talk about it, and because Republicans aren't interested in pouncing on them for it, since they themselves, you know, are really the party that wants to cut food stamps, there just hasn't been as much attention paid as there usually would be for something of this magnitude. It just doesn't have the political fighting angle that gets people interested usually in these kinds of stories. So that's why I think it's been a little bit of a sleeper hit among all the other budget cuts that have happened in the last couple of years.
What about the potential hit to come from the farm bill that's now being debated?
Well, what Republicans are wanting is a 5% annual reduction, and that would reduce food stamp spending by about $4 billion each year. And the way they would do it would be by changing eligibility standards, and it wouldn't reduce monthly benefit levels for the vast majority of food stamp recipients if Republicans got their way, but it would push about 4 million people off the program next year. But their demand is viewed on Capitol Hill as very harsh, and much harsher than what Democrats in the Senate have been willing to do. So it's really unlikely that through the Farm Bill Conference Committee that's now underway, Republicans will get all of what they want. So the food stamp cut that happened on Friday will remain as the biggest cut to the program.
That was Arthur Delaney of the Huffington Post talking to KCRW's Warren Olney. You can find the full 45-minute conversation from Monday's To the Point about the food stamp budget cuts on our blog. The story of food is really the story of water. From irrigation on the farm to tap water we boil for a pot of soup or a cup of tea. This week marks the 100th anniversary of the Los Angeles Aqueduct, and KCRW's Madeline Brand hosted a riveting radio documentary called Power and Water, the Los Angeles Aqueduct at 100. The special feature documents the who, the how, and the why of the water wars that William Mulholland launched a century ago. During her reportage, Brand visited a cattle rancher in the Owens Valley who says that those water wars are not over. Here's a clip from her story.
Daris Moxley is a cattle rancher in Bishop. Her animals graze in a yellowing field just behind the double-wide trailer she shares with her husband.
I fight with the neighbors over the ditch, and the ditch guy, the guy down the road will call and say, I don't have any water, you've got all the water. Like they say, you know, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting, and that's what is really happening here.
Daris has seen these wars off and on for most of her life.
I've lived here since I was 5 years old, and my grandparents had the place in the early 30s, and it was a DWP lease then.
Back then, the DWP struck a deal with Owens Valley residents like Daris's grandparents. We'll lease you the land for next to nothing, but you only get so much water. And that's the irony. As much as people here complain about the DWP, there's no way that Daris's family could afford to live on this land if she owned it. The taxes alone would drive her out. As it is, she leases 200 acres for just $4,000 a year.
And if it wasn't for DWP, we wouldn't have it.
She can enjoy it, but she can't make a living off it. The cows are mainly a hobby. The old wooden table, pulley, and ropes you can see from their front gate is only used to slaughter 4 or 5 head a year for friends and family only.
We did have 30 to 40 mother cows, and now we're down to 10 or 12.
All because of the water?
Yes. They say, no, we're getting our 5 acre feet, so that's what we get.
Like it or not.
Like it or not.
Like a junkie, L.A. keeps coming back for more water as it gets bigger and bigger. Now, 4 million people. Not only does the city take water from the Owens River, it's now pumping out the valley's aquifer, the water beneath the ground where Daris and I are standing in her backyard. The aquifer is like a giant sponge soaking up rainwater. Los Angeles has been squeezing that sponge for decades. The water is wrung out 200 miles south in our showers and on our green lawns.
The whole valley is suffering because of DWP.
How is it suffering?
The vegetation is deteriorating, and anybody can see that. I mean, all you have to do is go out and look. Even the sagebrush is dying. Your springs have dried up. Everything's dried up, and they just keep taking the water. So I think we're just pretty much the end of an era here.
If you missed the full hour-long special earlier this week, download it or stream it from our blog. I guarantee you'll have a driveway moment. I did. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. A big thanks to the Good Food team. That would be Jillian, Laryl, Sarah, Caroline, Harriet, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.